Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
And this is London, of course, but coming to you all over the world, thanks to the wonders of the internet. Now, the Russians take this coronavirus so seriously, they sent someone over from Moscow who greeted me at the door in a hazmat suit because they'd heard a rumour that I had been asking for a coronavirus test. But I was asking for you, and for you, and you, and all the millions of people who simply cannot get a coronavirus test, whether they're young, middle-aged, or old, I didn't mean me, when they have symptoms, like a cough, as I did, like a slight temperature, as I did. But I tried day and night for 3 whole days to get a slot anywhere at all. I was ready to drive by anywhere to get a coronavirus test, and I couldn't even get an answer, never mind a coronavirus test. Now, we have spent uncountable billions of pounds of public money on a testing regime, a testing system, which simply hasn't worked. And the contracts for that were handed out without tender and without any concept, obviously, of performance-related pay to companies, oftentimes with absolutely no track record at all in that field. And all of them had the common denominator of being friends with leading figures in the Conservative government. This is a gigantic scandal. In fact, if we close down this week, as the Sunday papers are suggesting we might, back to square one, you remember it, stay home, save lives, protect the NHS. We did that too late, and we lifted that too early. You'll remember here when it changed. Stay alert, like you can stay alert to a coronavirus and get back to work. Everyone pushed out of their homes that they were previously told to stay in. Well, neither approach has worked. The virus is back. Thousands of people are getting it now every day, and the numbers are doubling every week. Doubling. And we are within days of losing control, according to a member of the SAGE panel earlier today. SAGE is the scientific advisory group to the government. And if that happens, then we're back to square one. We're back to staying home, saving lives, trying to protect the NHS. But why didn't the NHS get the job of carrying out the tests? Why didn't the local authorities, who know the areas that they represent, get the job? Why did it have to go to bandit capitalist outfits who have utterly failed in the task that they were so lavishly paid for? I'll be asking that question in the course of this evening with Dr. Ranjit, but maybe also with others. What's the difference, by the way, between normal capitalism and bandit capitalism? Well, in one word, it's a C word, forgive me, Carillion. We'll be talking to Bob Wiley, my old friend and author of the best new book of the year, Bandit Capitalism, about the Carillion scandal. Now, you might not have been affected by the collapse of this Ponzi scheme called Carillion, but you might be wrong, because when you survey the wreckage of Britain that was left by the collapse of Carillion, you'd be amazed at the people and places that were affected. Nowhere on the globe is, of course, as stricken right now as the United States of America. Just ponder that for a moment. The world's most powerful country. The world of whom it used to be sung, I want to be an American. A country that had such soft power that almost all of us grew up on their television and their film and their music and to some extent also their sports, not the ones they bodlerized from us, but some of the other sports, athletics, boxing, and so on, at which they excelled. America bestrode the world like a colossus. Now it's on its knees. Its economy is in absolute free fall. Its society is falling apart at the seams. And yet, two sclerotic, elderly, dubious mentally candidates are punching it out, if you want to call it that, for president in November. Whether the big ugly bear, Donald Trump, is going to scrape home again, or whether a man who not only can't tie shoelaces, given up wearing shoes with laces, but doesn't know his wife from his sister, doesn't know which state he's in, doesn't know which office he's running for, is being worked from the back by the oligarchs of the Clinton-Obama era, and who'll be quickly pushed over a cliff, maybe even literally, if he gets in November. And then we'll have President Kamala Harris. What could possibly go wrong? We'll be talking to Dr. Richard Wolff in just a few minutes. He is the intellectual political colossus. He should be the president of the United States. Never mind Bernie Sanders. He's cleverer than Bernie Sanders. Never mind Bernie Sanders. He's a better orator than Bernie Sanders. If they listened to him, America would not be in the state it's in. But he's not running for president. But he is now a regular on our show. And we are very, very lucky to have him. Here's the first poll. Why is Sir Keir Starmer not 20 points ahead in the polls? That's what they used to say about Jeremy Corbyn, after all. And that was when the Conservative government wasn't one-tenth as cataclysmically stupid, incompetent and wrong as it is exposed to be today. Why is Sir Keir Starmer not 20 points ahead in the polls? A, he's not human. That's a good one, actually. To me, he's a desiccated calculating machine. But the only thing he's calculating is his own interests and the interests of the Blairite comprador that he has gathered around himself. B, he's dull. My goodness, that goes without saying. So wooden, the birds are trying to nest in him. C, he's Tony Blair without the laughs. Well, that is interesting because there was a poll this week. They did win. And that poll asked who was the most similar to Tony Blair in the British political firmament. I can hardly say firmament without laughing. And of course, Sir Keir Starmer won it out the park. He is Tony Blair, but without the redeeming features of Tony Blair. Tony Blair could make you feel like you were 10 foot tall. Tony Blair had charm. He had humor, polish. He was an orator of sorts, even though it was all scripted and on an auto cue. But Keir Starmer can't do any of those things. He's an automaton. That's my view of him. I'd vote for all three of those, but you can take your pick, which is the most apposite. Keir Starmer, you're getting it tonight. So, after this brief break, we've got Dr. Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics, author of Understanding Socialism, host of Economic Update, and co-founder of democracyatwork.info on all things American, who joins us now. Dr. Wolff, thank you for coming back on the show. You're a very, very popular guest indeed, and rightly so. Let's summarize the economic situation since. The last time we spoke, we looked like we were looking over the edge of the abyss and an apocalyptic vision was conjured as to where the United States might be by the end of the year, whoever wins the presidency. Has that mitigated in any way or even got worse?
Well, I think it hasn't changed much. And if it has changed, it's really a kind of stretching out. Mr. Trump is doing all that he can to distract people by any and every means. You mentioned them correctly before, including foreign activities and throwing his weight around, scapegoating China or Iran or virtually anybody who he can think of that might appeal to that part of his country that follows him. But no, the economic situation is in fact a kind of slow burning disaster. Now, let me give you two or three examples. Number one, for several months now, many millions of Americans, homeowners or people in apartments, have not paid their rent and have not paid their mortgage payments, which are normally due every month. Likewise, millions of our businesses have also not paid their rent to the buildings in which they're located, to the malls in which they're situated, and so on. An explosion is building that will be an immense struggle between both the residential and commercial tenants on the one hand and the landlords on the other. And at the same time, the landlords, because they cannot collect rents, are not paying off the banks from whom they have borrowed money. Everyone is going into court to sue everyone else. And the level of pandemonium guarantees that no investments are going to be made in many, many areas because the uncertainty compounds all of these problems. And then the uncertainty, by cutting off any kind of investment, slows any prospect of returning, quote unquote, to normal. And my last point would be, normal is no objective anyway, because it's the normal we had before all of this that now collapsed. Lost in the fudge of all of this was a lovely factor which came to light since I last spoke with you. The National Bureau of Economic Research here in the United States, the official timekeeper for our economic ups and downs of capitalism's great instability, decided to announce that the current economic crash, because that's what it is, started in February. And the reason this is interesting is that the pandemic, the virus, did not really get to the United States in any significant way until March, making it a bit of a bad joke to refer to this as the COVID-19 crash, because clearly capitalism was crashing anyway, and the pandemic only made it that much worse.
It is extraordinary that the country they excoriate so savagely is the only country that is actually forging ahead now, after having been the first to report and record and describe the virus and send it around the world so everyone else could get ready for it. China has bounced back. Other countries like Britain have had a recovery in the third quarter. We'll see if that survives the news that seems to be coming this week that the spike of the second wave is well and truly among us. But China has powered ahead. So the country they can't stop hating on is the one that has done the best in dealing with the virus and avoiding economic catastrophe. That's what lies behind all this hostility towards China, isn't it?
That's part of it. It's an attempt to blame China. Mr. Trump likes in his public speaking to refer to it as the China flu and other phrases like that. Absolutely. China is being scapegoated here for the pandemic, but also for the fact that somehow they are being accused now of cheating. I love the phrase cheating. In other words, getting benefits from American corporations that can explain to the shocked American people how much progress China has made in the last 30 years. during every which one of those years, by the way. Economic growth in the United States over the last 30 years, in case people don't know this, has been in the neighborhood of 2 to 2.5%. And over the same period, the Chinese economic growth has been between 6 and 8%, which explains why they're catching up, why they have surpassed the United States. But there is a fundamental issue here that shouldn't get lost. The United States has roughly 4.5% of the world's population. And we have well over 20% of all the COVID cases and all the COVID deaths in the world. For a very wealthy country that parades itself around as the most efficient, the most developed, the most industrialized, etc., what I just said is a colossal fact of failure in this society. Failure to prepare for the pandemic and failure to contain it once it comes here. And the president is in desperate urgency to try to escape being blamed for the failure to prepare and the failure to contain. He is by no means the only reason for that failure, but he is certainly a major player in producing that failure. And much of the election will hang on whether or not he is successful in dispersing the attention, focusing the media elsewhere, creating pandemonium in the election process, which is a severe problem here, or just redirecting attention away from the colossal mess that he has now as the context for this election.
Now, the rats are deserting the ship in the hope of making it sink, it should be said. The people that he had around him, starting with John Bolton, but even members of his own family, and now the former defense grandees are spilling the beans about his loose mouth. There's no reason to doubt that he has a loose mouth, whether he said the things that they're saying he said, and why they didn't tell us that at the time are, of course, moot questions. But these rats, are they having an effect? These people publishing books and releasing tapes, is that chipping away at his chances of success?
Well, I think the answer there, however frustrating, has to be yes and no. Here's the way. Yes, for independent voters, for people who are still unsure about how they're going to vote, which is, according to the polls, a relatively small number, these things no doubt will have an effect. For all those who don't like Mr. Trump, all of this is simply more and more evidence of everything they had thought and believed now being concretized. But the other part, the frustrating part of my answer, is the depth of anger and bitterness in the American people, large sections of them. If you had to get a number, I would say a third of the American people are so bitter about what has happened to them, this American dream that they were told about all their life, which is completely beyond anything they can afford at this point. They're disintegrating benefits that used to go with their jobs but aren't there. All of these deprivations, the children's education, which is their only hope for a good job, which they cannot now afford without mountains of debt that they cannot repay. These situations have accumulated and made them angry and bitter. They don't want anything to do with either the conventional Republicans or the conventional Democrats. They voted for Mr. Trump because he acts unlike them. He is grotesque. He says what you're not supposed to say. He is crude and vulgar and hostile and divisive in all the ways that normal polite politics in this country avoided. It's not that he isn't a normal Republican. He is, but he just says it very bluntly and very starkly. And that third of the people wants that. They want change. They really do. Not the fake change that Obama promised but did not deliver. Not the fake change that Mr. Biden weakly repeats every day, but they really want something different. There was the irony that they were more interested in Bernie Sanders because he was clearly different by having the label socialist than they were in any other Democrat. And that was a parallel, if you like, to why they liked Mr. Trump. But because Bernie was pushed out and you're left with a centrist like Mr. Biden, what you're left with is an inability to mobilize the anti-Trump, while Mr. Trump uses his standard over-the-top rhetoric to mobilize his base, and that makes the outcome somewhat questionable.
Before we turn to Biden, this third of the American people of whom you speak, this is commonly described as Trump's base. It might be a little more than a third, probably not at all more than 40, but that's a lot of people in a country the size of the United States. A lot of people with guns, as well as anger. This mess around the system, the process of the elections, this is pregnant with some pretty scary, hairy possibilities, isn't it, of Trump refusing to accept the result of Supreme Court suits like we had when Bush triumphed over Gore, and maybe even violence on the streets with all the materiel that's around this question. That could be the spark, couldn't it?
Yes, it could, and I think Mr. Trump has perfected a strategy he used in 2016 that he is using again. If I could explain it this way, he knows that the mass, the majority of the United States, including the majority of the employer class in our society, are distressed by his government, frightened by the fighting in the streets, which has already begun, frightened by the level of hostility and basic division in the society. They would like, therefore, to make Mr. Trump and all of that go away. But they're afraid. They're afraid that Mr. Trump will mobilize all of the disgruntled, angry, bitter people for some sort of desperate, for example, refusal to accept the results of the election or refusal to leave office, no matter what the results of the election, et cetera, et cetera, and to mobilize even more trouble in the streets, even more white supremacy in a society that is going to be majority non-white in a very few years. All of these are threats. He threatened that in the 2016. He's threatening it again. His basic strategy is this: to go to the mass of the people who run the American society and say, yes, I'm dangerous, but I'm less dangerous if you cut a deal with me than I can be for you if you don't. And I think a good number of them are wobbling. They might prefer Mr. Biden. They almost certainly do. He's the calm, normal government that has been so profitable for American big business for the last 30 years. But they're fearful that if they go to Biden, Mr. Trump may make good on unleashing the guns, the white supremacists, the bitter, angry motorcycle gangs, the police that are upset because they're caught in an impossible position. And so he threatens to literally have a civil war. And to avoid that, they may actually give him another 4 years.
Fascinating. Finally, and I'm grateful for your time as always, Professor. Joe Biden, you know I mean no disrespect at all to the American people by asking this question this way. But it is simply incredible, literally incredible, in the rest of the world, that a country as great as yours, as mighty as yours, with the level of can-do and know-how and so on that your society has, that the best the political class could find to put up against this monster was Joe Biden. How should I explain that to people?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, I think you're going to have to explain to people, as I try to, that the greatness, the power, the capability, and you're very kind about it, and I think you're right about it. As an American, I say that. But much of that is now in a fairly advanced stage of decline. I am not an alarmist. I have not said this before in my life. But as I look at the level of difficulties this country has worked its way into, with the level of social problems that it has kicked down the road over decades and not solved, and now confronts the explosion of the fires in the West, which are like a metaphor for the failure to deal with global warming, the failure to heed the warnings for that, just as you failed to hear the warnings for pandemics, or that you failed to recognize that the capitalist system crashes every 4 to 7 years, and that since the last one was in 2008, we were already overdue, and that if these things happen together, well, then it's too much. We all knew that. But this is a system frozen in the kind of old economic self-content, the old politics that articulates that, the normal Republicans and normal Democrats, that they continue to play their games as if the system around them was not falling apart. It reminds us here in America of what we have read about those moments when the Greek Empire or the Roman Empire, or if I may, the British Empire, was going down the tubes, but the people running it acted as if nothing like that was happening, as if they could have the same concerts and the same lavish dinners and the same cricket matches, and in this country, the same professional sports. But of course, we can't have professional sports because our professional athletes have refused to play because they understand the decline and are now expressing it. I think you're seeing the United States beginning that kind of disintegration that explains the absurdity of a Donald Trump on one extreme and the absurdity of coming up with nothing better than Joseph Biden on the other. It is a bizarre display of a society unable and unwilling to face the accumulated problems it has.
Apocalypse, if not now, then perhaps soon. Thank you for a rare, rare interview, Dr. Richard Wolff. Thank you for joining us again on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Wow, that interview deserves to spread far and wide, in my view. Now, Bob Wiley has produced, I think, the book of the year. He's the author of Bandit Capitalism, Carillion, and the Corruption of the British State. When he started out writing it, he may have thought it was an historical work, looking back at one of the biggest scandals in British capitalism in many decades. But actually, as we slump deeper and deeper into crisis, we are seeing shafts of light which illuminate the extent to which that corruption is still with us. And I referred to some of it earlier in relation to the gigantic contracts of £100 billion and more that have been handed out to friends of the government, capitalist companies with no track record at all in the business that they were being handed, and certainly no performance-related pay. That corruption of the British state is still with us, even if Carillion is not. Bob Wiley, a veteran journalist and broadcaster, joins me now. Bob, welcome to the show. I must say you've come on since we wrote a book together 30 years ago. This is a corker, I must say. I wish I had more time to go through it in more detail with you. But I want to start with the prologue, which, to my surprise, went into great detail about the Russian oligarchs, the formation of that oligarch class. What has that got to do with the collapse of Carillion?
Well, George, you know, and a lot of people know now, that the Russian oligarchs looted the Russian state. They bought up the Russian mineral mountains, the oil, the massive oil and gas reserves. But the problem for the Russian economy was that they paid in millions, and a matter of a year or so later, their holdings were worth billions. So the Russian oligarchs, as they became known, have looted the Russian state and became unimaginably rich doing so. And they're now unaccountable and untouchable. But they've got British cousins, you see. They've got British cousins who are the British oligarchs. People like the heads of Carillion, who might be called the Carillionaires, they are equally living proof of the looting of the British state. These are the heads collectively of huge companies in Britain, which have got rich in gigantic privatisation rackets and ripped off the public in rip-off contracts for all sorts of government business. So Carillion, the book is titled Bandit Capitalism. That's the right name for it. So that's why it's called Bandit Capitalism. It's about the British oligarchs and their bandit capitalism.
It's truly brilliant and a wonderful cover, and full marks to the GMB trade union for their help in getting this book to the market. So remind us what happened with Carillion. This was a $5 billion a year company that finished with 29 million in the bank, but £7 billion worth of debts. Has anyone gone to jail for this, Bob?
No, not yet, George. There is no real calling to account at any level of those who have stood at the top of Carillion. In fact, come January next year, it's 3 years since the Carillion collapse, and not a single director has been held to account. The regulators have implemented 4 inquiries. The Insolvency Service actually had a fast-track inquiry. They haven't reported. And in fact, when I asked them why they hadn't the other day, they said, don't you understand? By legal positions, we've got 3 years to report. So far, Bob, George, nobody has been held to account. Nobody has been held to account for Carillion developing like a giant Ponzi scheme on the Never Never.
Explain that, Bob. It's a very serious charge, and your lawyers let you make it so you can back it up. A Ponzi scheme is a criminal enterprise.
Well, I use Ponzi scheme as a way of describing how Carillion developed. Let me try and give you an explainer. Let's take Mr. and Mrs. Smith, who live in London. Their outgoings in their household have, over a period of time, become much more than their earning in wages. So they start to plug the gap with credit cards. So They live a higher lifestyle than they can afford by plugging the gap that they've got in income over expenditure by using the visa. And then when that visa dies, they can't pay that visa, they get another card at a higher interest and they're paying that off. In the end, they can't pay the bills. And that's what happened to Carillion. They ran their company almost like a household, thinking that you could count the amount of money on your visa as income. Carillion, at one stage, in 2009, Carillion had loans worth 200 million. By the time it went down the Swanee, the loans were 1.3 billion. So assets hardly grew in the same period. And at the end of the day, like any Ponzi scheme, Carillion came to an end. Never, Never Land didn't work.
What was the impact, the wreckage, that the collapse of Carillion left?
Well, I mean, obviously, from the word go, there were thousands of workers who lost their jobs. But the real heavy hit was taken by Carillion suppliers. 30,000 businesses, small businesses in the main, who supplied the Carillion construction and services effort, 30,000 were left out to the tune of £2 billion. Many of these businesses went bust. They went to the wall. They weren't paid. The directors walked away counting the money, and small businesses were left with £2 billion worth of bills that were never paid. The other element in a you know, this earth-shattering crime in business terms in Britain, the other element is that while the directors had private pension schemes, the top man, Richard Howson and Richard Adam, the finance organiser, in 5 years had £1.8 million paid into their pension schemes between the two of them, £1.8 million. While they allowed the deficit on the pension fund for the workers to go to £990 million. Now, the government had to step in the pension fund, and that's cost the taxpayer £2.6 billion in terms of how to make restitution. But the pensioners at Carillion, the workers, their pensions have gone down by 10% overnight.
Now, they always say that lessons will be learned. Have lessons been learned? Or is there another Carillion round the corner?
Well, there is another Carillion round the corner and many other Carillions round the corner. In March of last year, Interserve, which is another of these construction and services companies, they went into administration on the verge of bankruptcy. Funnily enough, Carillion-like, there was debts of £750 million and a hole in the books of £100 million. Now, in the very year when those accounts were delivered, the same accounts show that the two directors at the top of Interserve were paid £1.3 million between them, and for good luck and services to mankind and humankind, their bonuses on top were £656,000. So,
plus nice work if you can get it. Show. Let me ask you a question. Maybe you can't answer it. Maybe beyond the purview of your book. Where are the auditors, these great auditing firms, owning skyscrapers all over London? Where are these auditors in these kind of stories?
George, it is a story which you couldn't make up. The big four auditors, as you know, are KPMG, Deloitte, Pricewaterhouse, and Ernst & Young, and they've got their fingerprints all over the Carillion story. Let me give you one picture it if you like. KPMG were Carillion's auditors for 19 years. And they were paid £19 million for their trouble. In the 19 years, they never, ever issued a single audit with a complaint. It was always tick the box, tickety-boo, all these accounts are fair, accurate, and we approve them. KPMG approved the Carillion accounts in March of 2017, and 3 months later, a hole of £845 million was discovered in the books. £845 million. I mean, George, that doesn't just fall off the table. Oh, they said nobody could see it coming. Well, I'll tell you. If you thought about, you know, the old thing about the three monkeys. Well, for the big four, the three monkeys are hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. And it's nothing to do with us, Gov.
Brilliant, Bobby. How do people get the book?
Well, in the British context, it's www.birlin, which is the publisher, birlin.co.uk. And in the eastern seaboard of America, where I hear you've got many, many listeners and fans, George, they can get it in any outlet of Barnes & Noble.
Fantastic. Bob Wiley, congratulations. You've done a service to humanity by producing this book. Much obliged to you.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, following the frankly ridiculous election results that were declared in Belarus, where the long-standing president apparently returned a vote of more than 80%, widespread disorder broke out in the capital, Minsk. The Western countries who preyed on similar situations elsewhere tried to crank it up into yet another color revolution. Not because they care at all about the people of Belarus. They almost certainly couldn't even identify its place on the map. But because they know that it has a border with Russia, and it is the policy of the NATO countries to park their tanks as close as possible to the Moscow government's lawn, they moved in immediately. Let's hear how that's all going. From Mark Sleboda, who is an international relations expert and a security analyst, who joins us from Moscow. Mark, welcome to the Mother of All Talk Shows. First of all, paint a picture of how the situation is in Belarus. Is it escalating, declining? Is it a real existential threat to the president? Give us a story.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be on the Mother of All Talk Shows.
Thank you.
In Minsk right now, the situation is kind of at an impasse, a status quo, where it's not easy to see how it will change either way towards the embattled president or supposed president, Alexander Lukashenko, or the protest movement, which is still gathering crowds once a week at least of and around 100,000 people or close to it on the streets of the capital, and smaller protests, but significant in other areas of the country. There was about a month ago, the protest movement was gathering steam, and it was joined by calls for a nationwide strike. And some strikes did break out at companies, including state companies, which is really important because state companies, and more importantly, their employees, state company workers, which are the majority of jobs in the Belarusian in Belarus, they are Lukashenko's core, his base. So a potential strikes from that sector against him in support of the protesters would indeed be very serious. But those strikes have almost entirely petered out at this point. The protests have lost a little bit of steam, but are still gathering firm numbers. But the police, the military, the security services, all of that, which is vital, the vital organs of the state, are still completely loyal, no cracks at all. And without cracks there or within Belarus's rather tame parliament, it is really hard to see that no matter the declarations of Lithuania and other countries in a John Guaido-like fashion, claiming that another candidate who was on the ballot of what is generally regarded to be a fraudulent election, not accepted, is certainly not in the West, and treated with a high degree of skepticism in Russia. In the words of the Russian foreign minister, Lavrov, they called it less than perfect. But without some change on one of these grounds, it's difficult to see how the protesters could further shake power in Belarus. It's kind of at an impasse, and things have been status quo for about the last 2 weeks. Lukashenko is due to arrive in Russia, in Sochi, tomorrow to speak to Putin, where Russia's support, Russia, the Russian government, Putin, does not love Lukashenko. But right now, they probably see him as the best of bad options, and are hoping to use his weakened position to further integration of the already existing Russian-Belarusian Union state, which he has been dragging his feet on and flirting with the West for several years now.
Yeah, well, it's only recently that Mike Pompeo was there. They used to call him the last dictator in Europe, but they were making big eyes at him when Pompeo was there. They obviously hoped to poach him without the need for a color revolution. I'll come back to the Russian stand in a minute, but I wanted to ask you if you thought the opposition had been damaged by the, you put it as well as I could, the Juan Guaido ization of the opposition leader, or the leading candidate, at least. Were they damaged? Did they look as if they were tools of NATO and those who wished Russia ill rather than people who wished Belarus well?
Yeah.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, the leader of the protest movement de facto right now, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, she's a housewife, the wife of a liberal blogger who was originally on the ballot, but was removed and imprisoned. And there were also two much establishment pro-Russia opposition candidates on the ballot who had much more popular support at that time. Viktor Babariko, who was the head of Gazprom Bank in Belarus, and Valery Tsepkalo, who was once Belarus's ambassador to the United States. They were seen as largely pro-Russian figures, and they were wiped off the ballot. And that really restricted Russia's room of maneuver with this election. It was kind of a clever play by Lukashenko. So the only one left on the ballot of any real significance to oppose him was this housewife, Tikhanovskaya, and the opposition coalesced around her, mostly for the purposes of seeing Lukashenko out of power. She has set up a shadow government out of the EU, out of Lithuania at this point. And Lithuania, at least, has recognized her as the president-elect of Belarus. How so? If the election was fraudulent, how another candidate on it can then claim to be president, I'm not quite sure. But she has since, she's spoken with the EU Parliament. She spoken to them directly. She has done photo ops with Bernard Henry Levy. She has had meetings with the U.S. State Department, a deputy of the U.S. State Department, Deputy Secretary of State. And the Kremlin knows all of this sudden as, we can't allow her to take power. We can't allow these protests, which are largely not anti-Russian, pro-Russian. They're more about internal matters of Belarus. And Belarus doesn't have the same large number of anti-Russian national identity politics as West Ukraine did. So these protests are different. They are largely peaceful on the protester side. They're not overtly violent. And you don't have this big nationalist movement that's a part of it. It exists, but it's much smaller. The Kremlin sees the leaders of the opposition, Tikhanovskaya and the group around, basically operating out of the EU with their blessing and support, says that whatever they say to the contrary, that they want to hijack these protests and use it to geopolitically flip Belarus into the Western camp. And that's certainly what the West wants, what the US, the EU wants and is pushing for out of this situation. That's why Russia is kind of gritting their teeth and making do with Lukashenko for the moment. They've offered him rather tepid support while basically setting terms demanding further integration with the Union state. The protest movement, I don't think that those who have been actively involved will be that dismayed by this development, this linkage, John Guaido style, with the EU, Lithuania declaring their own president of Belarus. But it may alienate other portions of the Belarusian population that were sitting on the fence, not really getting tired of Lukashenko after 26 years, but not wanting to become a NATO anti-Russian state in the process either. We'll have to see how opinion polls, there aren't any direct ones, but we should get some idea of how support might change because of that and what comes out of this meeting between Lukashenko and Putin tomorrow in the coming weeks.
I thought that President Putin was remarkably insouciant about the whole thing, and Russia was taking really rather a risk by its hands-off approach to it in the early days, weeks of this process. But as you describe it, it would appear to be another example of Putin's sagacity. He has not dirtied his hands by embracing Lukashenko's, in my opinion, bogus election victory, but neither has the situation gotten so out of control that Belarus becomes another Ukraine.
That's certainly the intention. It's a fine balance. And the Kremlin is rather good in such foreign policy situations of sitting back and doing nothing. Sometimes doing nothing is worse or is better than doing something, as the U.S. and the EU constantly feel the need to meddle and invert themselves. The Russian government's position is what's happening in Belarus is a domestic matter. There is a union state between the two of them. A lot of people ignore that. You don't need a visa to go back and forth, right? You can reside in either country. There's no customs or duties at the border between the two countries. And it was envisioned to grow much more into an EU-type thing. Lukashenko's been dragging his feet. But that said, Russia doesn't believe that it should insert itself into other countries' domestic politics like this. They've got a number of allies in the Eurasian Union, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, the Commonwealth of Independent States, that if Russia was seen to be ushering Lukashenko out under whatever circumstances, they might get nervous and be and kind of shy away from these organizations with Russia because of some lingering fears of Russian imperialism dictating their own internal politics and putting themselves at risk. Russia doesn't want that. So unlike the US and EU, which constantly meddle, they like to keep a standoff approach. The Central Election Commission of Belarus, the organs of state power, have declared that Lukashenko is the president. If you say so, we're not really in a position to question that. But they will not allow violent street protests to emerge backed by the West, as they were in Ukraine, which topples the government into a street revolution type situation where there could be a dramatic geopolitical flipping. So I think that what we'll see in Sochi out of these meetings with Lukashenko is that Putin will hold Lukashenko to his statement that he would see Belarus through a gradual transformation of power, a reform, particularly of constitutional reform that'll reduce the powers of the president's office and give more power to the parliament and other areas where pro-Russian popular sentiment and political forces within the parliament, within civil society, could exert greater influence over Lukashenko and hold him to any deals he might make with Putin while he's feeling weak right now. But, Russia is playing a risk here because they are risking, the government, the Russian government, the Kremlin, is risking alienating what is undoubtedly a large segment of the Belarusian population, justifiably outraged at the fraudulent election. And he doesn't want to drive them completely into the West's camp by being seen as supporting Lukashenko too much or without any caveats.
Mark Sliboda, thanks very much indeed for that tour de force. Thanks for joining us on the mother of all talk shows. The state of Britain's response to the coronavirus, but they absolutely buttress what I was saying earlier in the show. The testing, tracing, contacting system has completely broken down. And we have paid, I don't know how many billions, my estimate is more than £100 billion on PPE fiascos, and on test, trace, and track fiascos. And we are about to launch, I think he called it moonshot, but I called it moonshine, Boris Johnson's £100 billion plan to basically test everybody all the time. Which, by the way, is what South Korea did from the beginning. You can get a coronavirus test at the bus stop in South Korea. But we, the sixth biggest economy in the world, and with a government with a majority of 80, a stable, powerful government, have made a terrible cod of this entire business. And when I just heard on the news that 176,000 swabs are in a backlog, not tested, not analysed, rather, when I heard that 90% of people cannot get a test, I know that to be true because, as I said earlier, I tried hard to get a test. And someone who should know, I can't divulge their identity, it would be dishonourable to do so, but who is in a position to know, told me that 80%, it's now 90, 80% of people looking for a test cannot get one. This when Hancock is telling us daily how much he's ramped everything up. I've lost count of the number of ramping ups there have been. Let's talk to Moat's medic, Dr. Ranjit Brar. Dr. Ranjit, welcome back. The story is back. The virus is back. How worried should we be?
George, hi, good to see you. In a way, the story never really went away, George. You've been talking about the inadequacies of testing, tracking, isolation. We said from the very beginning, all the way back in March when we first spoke on the show, George, that the way that the countries had successfully dealt with coronavirus was to have very accurate sight of where the virus was, i.e. by rapidly developing large-scale testing. And then those people who had the virus, seeing how infectious it was and how easily under normal societal conditions, as we used to enjoy just 6 months ago, the virus could spread. The plan was to isolate the virus from the community rather than stop the whole community from moving. And as a result, those countries have essentially returned to normal, though the virus has continued to rampage throughout the world. Now, much of the world, if you look at South America, if you look at parts of South Asia, parts of India, you see that extreme poverty, as well as poor medical provision in those states, has exacerbated the spread. But as you said, United States and the United Kingdom, our governments, because of their ideology, their laissez-faire economic ideology, which also kind of then spread into their field of public health. They've always, the Tories have always said they don't believe in a nanny state. They don't believe in, you know, provision. They've sometimes, not infrequently, backbench MPs of the Conservative Party denounced the NHS as the last socialist institution or the last Stalinist institution, in their words. So they don't believe in providing on a national basis healthcare for all. And they don't believe in alleviating poverty, which is why our indexes of poverty are pretty appalling even before this economic problem and before the latest economic crisis and coronavirus. So that's led to the massive spreads that we've seen. And herd immunity has been really the policy throughout this pandemic on the part of our government, laced with, as they've seen the size of the problem burgeoning, you know, kind of accusatory statements against the public, that it's the public's fault they're not following guidelines. That recently this week, Matt Hancock has been saying quite often, you know, he doesn't want people who are not eligible for testing to turn up and have tests because they're creating this backlog in the system. But the system itself lacked capacity when it really mattered, when the virus was spreading exponentially. Then, you know, through lockdown, the numbers were greatly reduced through summer. We know the deaths have been greatly reduced, but we know we've not had adequate sight. And even in that lowest point of the virus, we think probably 4,000 people were getting it a week. The last few days we've seen in testing, test-proved cases, 3,500 cases a day have been shown on testing, which represents a large increase. And the studies of Imperial, the large kind of population-based studies, are suggesting that the R rate, the reproduction rate, is now 1.7, though the government is trying to put out lower figures. 1.7 means essentially that this virus again is back to the point of doubling every week in terms of the numbers who have it. And while the deaths have been low, it's been essentially shown that that's chiefly because the numbers of young people who've been getting the virus have been disproportionately high. But this week we've also seen a worrying new sign. I was just reading the Sunday Times today. They're saying there have been 43 outbreaks again, new outbreaks this week in care homes of the coronavirus, with 1,100 cases per week of the elderly in care homes. We know they're the most vulnerable population, most likely over 80-year-olds. We know have a mortality rate of some 14%. So it does. These are extremely worrying signs that, as we said last week, you know, maybe young people who predominantly have the virus, but there's no way, you know, easily of confining the virus just to a certain demographic, and it's likely to presage a wider spread in the community, George.
You've partly answered my next question by pointing out that if a significant number of younger and healthier people get it, they're less likely to die of it, maybe even less likely to have to go into hospital with it. But the young people, of course, are mixing all the time with older people, their own parents, their own grandparents, people that are older and sicker, frailer, weaker than them, all the time at work, in shops, and so on. So that would not be a cap on hospitalizations and deaths in the long term if they were passing it on. You've partly answered that. But there is a school of thought, you will have heard it earlier in the show, that actually the virus is weaker and that it's not hospitalizing or killing as many people because effectively it's running out of steam. What's your view on that?
I've been looking at that question over the last period as deaths have been falling to see if that's true. There was certain articles I read that the virus is becoming less angry. There were only speculation from sometimes hospital clinicians based on the fact that they were seeing fewer hospitalizations. But I don't think that the scientific and genetic evidence really backs that up. I was reading some papers in Nature and Cell on this question, trying to see what the prevalent scientific opinion was based on their testing. And while there are a very large number of mutations, we've said, you know, every time a genetic sequence is copied, there can be mistakes in that copy. And whilst complex cells, as yours and mine, have mechanisms to correct those, simple viruses don't have such complex mechanisms to correct them. And therefore, the rate of mutation of viruses, which are present in millions of people around the world, we know currently there have been 29 million people around the world who have been test-proven cases. But if you look at the fact that in the United Kingdom, we're saying around 350 people have been test-proven. But if you look at the wider apps based on self-reporting of symptoms, the estimates are probably that around 3 million people within the UK have had that virus. So millions and millions of people have the virus. Each person that has the virus replicates millions and millions of times. So there's many opportunities for mistakes to be made in the replication of the single-stranded RNA, which makes up the coronavirus sequence. And probably 10 or 12,000 slight variations, but they're very minor variations. One that's particularly gained prominence is this D614G mutation. It's a single point mutation, and people have been interested in it because it is within the spike protein of the coronavirus. And we know the spike protein is the way in which the virus latches onto this angiotensin converting in this ACE2 receptor on the surface of the lung epithelium. That's the way it's internalized. But actually, that mutation has become so prevalent around the world that actually scientists kind of consider that mutation actually really just to be the virus. That is what the pandemic is. And if anything, that's made the virus slightly more infective. It's one of the more infective strains. That's probably why it's so much more prevalent than other mutations that have been found. But it doesn't seem that it's any less harmful. The estimates vary. If you look at the whole world of tested population, if there have been 29 million people proven to have contracted this virus worldwide by testing, of those 930,000 have died. And that accounts for a 4% very crude estimate of death rate. Now, of course, we know many more people have the virus than are tested, but equally, we do also know that the deaths are far higher than we have proven, because those deaths are only people who have test positive and have been reported as having coronavirus deaths. And we know that, you know, even in the UK care home, during the weeks of the pandemic, there were probably 60,000 deaths in care home, which was well in excess of normal. We know that actually there were 80,000 excess deaths within that short period of time. So we know deaths are far higher than estimated, even in the UK where records are good, let alone the rest of the world. So, you know, probably the rate of mortality remains between 1 and 2%, maybe as high as 2%, and maybe slightly higher in countries where there's an older population, a sicker population, and where healthcare facilities are poor, where the population may be immunosuppressed or malnourished. And that's why in the third world, we're not absolutely sure. Figures are bad. We don't know whether the relatively young population will protect those in the most exploited sections of the population worldwide, or whether the fact that actually they're relatively malnourished and have very poor health facilities and cannot avoid the virus. I mean, Pakistan has relatively low rates. They've put in place a very good system of remuneration for workers who have been laid off. India have very poor rates for the most part. They did the reverse. They forced people from highly infected areas who were workers who couldn't get work to return to their villages, thus spreading it throughout the country. So, you know, I don't think there's clear evidence that the virus is getting less dangerous. There's a speculation in terms of genetic theory that, look, the viruses that are most successful are those which don't kill their host, because if you kill the host, you can't reproduce and spread. But we already know, actually, the mortality rate is quite low from coronavirus. So even if it has a high mortality in the elderly, it's able to spread quite freely throughout the population. And equally, the selection pressure for this new virus is low because essentially there's all at the beginning of this pandemic, so back in January, there was almost zero immunity in the world population to the virus. So there's not a great selection pressure for the virus to mutate in that sense. So I think that my overall summary of the evidence, as I can see it, read it, interpret it, and from my clinical practice, is that the virus hasn't changed significantly in its mortality. Currently, the death rates are low because it's the younger section of the population who are getting the virus, but that is already beginning to change, and we're seeing it spread to the more vulnerable sections of the population, George.
Finally, and I'm grateful for your time as always, someone, Alice, has asked me to ask you if you believe that Sweden have managed this virus better than the UK. There are a lot of people on the libertarian side of politics, for example, who began by praising Sweden's line on this, and then were silent for a time when Sweden then had a far higher death toll than its neighbouring countries, Norway and Denmark, but now are animated again in support of the Swedish line because Sweden's numbers are not now as bad as the likes of ours are. And by doing what they did not devastate their economy at the same time in the way that we have. The balance that we took was very different to the Swedish balance. What's your current thinking on Sweden?
I mean, I don't think extensively about Sweden, and I don't have extensive knowledge of the Swedish economy. Sweden's economy, it has an industrial economy, similar in many respects to ours. We have joint pharmaceutical companies. They are essentially a large capitalist economy as we are, but their population is much smaller. The population is around 10 million, whereas ours is 66 million. So the absolute numbers in Sweden have been relatively low. I think they've only recorded 6,000 or 7,000 deaths, but if you multiply that by six, it straight away comes up actually to our official tally, so that there's not a great deal of difference. Now, Sweden essentially thought that they wouldn't be, it was so infectious, the agent, that they wouldn't be able to limit its spread without very severe population measures. And therefore, they openly adopted and have maintained essentially a herd immunity policy. Now, if you listen to the Swedish policy makers, they would be the first to admit that actually they say it's far too early to see. They say we won't know for several years when the virus is totally gone, when they can calculate the absolute mortality rate, they'll be able to compare them accurately across countries and compare them with policies. Their current thinking is that probably it will make no difference. The UK may have issued a lockdown at a certain point, but it didn't do what some countries have done very effectively. If I wanted to point to a country that was very effective, I would again point to China. I would point to Korea, both North and South Korea. I would point to Taiwan. I would point to New Zealand to a lesser extent. Those countries early on took aggressive health measures to protect the population. And in protecting the population, they essentially eradicated the virus. And in eradicating the virus, they protected the health of their people who returned to normal. And that was the best way of protecting the economy. Those countries like Britain who thought that they would be able to let it rampage through the population, that it would be the relatively old who were culled is a strong word, but who were sacrificed, who would bear the brunt of the infection, suddenly woke up one morning when they were seeing the drastic effects in Italy and realized that 500,000 deaths, 600,000 deaths would be too politically toxic for them to manage and change their policy. But it was essentially too late. We'd had hundreds of instances of infection spreading from what was then the epicenter, not China, not Wuhan, but spreading from Europe to England. You'll remember that Easter, that March bank holiday season when there were people bringing back the virus from ski resorts and holidays all over Europe, the most wealthy, because as we know, the most wealthy 10% of the population are those who overwhelmingly fly and have those kind of holidays, bringing the virus back and spreading it. And our government did very little initially to stop its spread. We've talked a lot about the test and trace And perhaps you've explored that enough. But essentially, you know, if there are 200,000 people who are not getting tested now, if, as you say, quite rightly say, tens and hundreds of millions are being funneled away from the NHS into the private sector, the NHS's ability to deal with this pandemic is not being increased. Rather, the NHS is being systematically starved of resources during this crucial time of pandemic. Its own mechanisms of dealing with public health, health inequality are being whittled away, and that was actually the motivation behind the final closure of Public Health England, which itself was a body which had arisen as a result of previous attacks on the ability of the NHS to plan long-term for the health needs of our population. So our government, far from protecting the NHS to save lives, is neither protecting lives nor protecting the NHS, but rather it's wielding a hatchet on the NHS, which is having a devastating effect on health equality and health outcomes for the long term, for the working class of this country, George.
Thank you very much again, Dr. Ranjit Brar, for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Alas, we're going to be talking about this for a very long time. There is literally more than 100 people trying to get on, and there's only 20 minutes left. Peter in Dublin, let's hear from him.
Yes, George, how are you? Listen, have a short good last time, okay? And listen, don't cut me short again. And don't rant at me, please, you know? Listen, even after I listened to Dr. Yan Yabar, okay, I actually call him Ranit Idiot because he rants all about it. He tells all those things. He hasn't been in those countries at all. He doesn't do his research either, okay?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. But you're not talking to a doctor earlier, no? Ranjit Bar.
Dr. Ranjit Brar, yes, about the coronavirus.
Yes.
But you're phoning up about 9/11.
Yes, yes, I know, I know. What happened to Building 7? Do you remember Grenfell Towers?
The what towers?
The Grenfell Towers in England, you see? How long did it burn?
Grenfell, yes.
Yes, how long did it burn before it...
That wasn't struck by two airliners.
Yeah. No. Building 7?
No, Peter, I've had enough of you. Let me hear from Eves in Idaho. Go ahead, Eves.
Hello. Thank you for your beautiful show. And also, I would like to remind everybody that 9/11 is also the date of the assassination of the President Allende.
Yep.
By the CIA, you know. And so the CIA apparently works at least one day a year. But what I wanted to tell you, I would like to take the point of Walter, for instance, last year. And there is something which is called the fallacy of the prosecutor. This is... I'm going to take the last discussion of last week, and I'm going to point to certain statements, but not in order. You come up, you see, with the idea that, after all, you know, why the United States would go to such a big fuss, you know, to do what they have done all the time, and they don't need to blow up tower and to do like that. And this is true. And, you know, you have this famous statistician in England, Thomas Bayes, you know, in the 18th century, who would say that your statement is what he would call a prior. That means that before anything happened, it's reasonable to think that you have a good life, you're a politician, you are not going to start blowing up a tower and do things like that. But after, you have the evidence. So I take your caller, Walter, from last week, and we are going to admit, you may not agree, but we are going to admit that we have the evidence that Building 7 was brought down, because nobody has ever seen a building falling without any aircraft hitting it, and it was burning only on the south side, and no other building was investigated. And so let's assume that we have a new evidence now that Building 7 was brought down.
Yeah.
Now, according to Thomas Bayes, you know, he's a great statistician, the father of statistics, in fact, he will tell you, well, you have to reevaluate all your probability, because now that the because the question is September 11 an inside job of some kind, you know, done by a foreign country or whatever. But you have to reevaluate all your probability, knowing that Building 7 was brought down, and not only that, that we denied that it went down, then we botched the entire investigation, that the investigator was from Israel, basically the son of a Mossad agent. We have a lot of evidence who say all those probabilities have to be updated, and therefore we have to relaunch the investigation.
Stop you because of the hour only, Eve. It's a very interesting call. I have said from the day after the 9/11 Commission report that we need a new investigation, because the 9/11 report is substantially flawed and probably deliberately so. So you're pushing an open door here. I have been all these years demanding a new investigation. Harry is in Germany, in Bavaria, on the same subject. Go ahead, Harry.
Yes, hello, George. I'd like to talk about 9/11 as well. You've had a couple of callers on the subject already, and I'd just like to expand a little bit on that. This organization, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, this isn't a bunch of quacks. I know you've you seem to be a bit dubious about this man, Richard Gage.
No, I'm not. I'm not at all dubious, and I would never be disrespectful to an architect or an engineer. I respect their professional credentials, of course.
Right. Well, this organization
actually... No, I just don't know him, that's all.
Yeah. This organization actually has the support of a lot of family members who have been... trying to get to the truth in this matter. And if you take a look at the website of this organization, they will show you that it's virtually impossible that these buildings came down the way it was claimed by the US government. The official inquiry was run by NIST, and it was corrupt from the very beginning to the end. And anyone who's looked into that will realize that it's there has to be a new inquiry. Now, Richard Gage just looks at the technical aspects of these buildings coming down. But if you want to look at other reasons behind it, you've said, well, why do the Americans need to do this? Well,
it's a strong point, isn't it, Harry?
Yeah.
It's a strong point, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it allowed them to bring in the Patriot Act, Homeland Security.
Why would you have to take a risk of that magnitude to bring in a Patriot Act? Bush was the president.
But the Americans...
The Democrats support securocratic mass surveillance measures. Why would you need to take the risk of the electric chair for everyone involved, and there'd have to be a large number of people involved, in order to pass a Patriot Act?
But George, no one who's done this in the past has ever got the electric chair. They blew up the USS Maine. They staged the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Yes, but if any one of the people involved in lacing the Twin Towers with explosives to bring them down had blown the whistle, the entire administration would have gone to the electric chair.
No, they wouldn't. No, they wouldn't. They have the means to put through a cover up. This is not beyond.
One person involved in this vast crime never been identified and never come forward to clear their conscience? Why?
There have been people who have spoken out, and people have been silenced.
All right, Harry, that's enough. 9/11, Ed, especially if we're going to get Mr. Gage on next week. Thanks for the call. Let's change the subject. Sean is in Stevenage. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, up, George. How you doing?
Good.
Good, good, good. The 9/11 stuff is all fascinating.
Yes.
But I'm not here to talk about that.
Fascinating.
Well, yes, yes. And I got my own views, but I'm not going to add to your pain on that
Please.
I liked the interview with Bob Wiley earlier.
Yeah, he's very good. Yeah, he's a great big man, yeah.
Yeah, pick up on what he was saying and in a broader context about the British financial services industry and the state of capitalism in this country. Lest people forget, in 2008, we had the banking credit crunch, so-called. That cost this country £1.5 trillion. That figure was announced by David Cameron when he first took office. I think it's in Hansard somewhere, Telegraph and The Guardian, various articles that put together the total cost of this country. It cost us, ostensibly, 10 years of austerity after that to pay for it.
Yeah.
Where you look in with some folks, say, there's estimates and extrapolations that 130,000 people died because of that. It's cost us libraries, community centres, public services, council services, etc., etc. Fast forward to just nearly 10 years ago, and the Carillion collapsing, Interserve nearly collapsing. We've learned nothing. Those four accountancy firms that were mentioned, they were the ones that signed off the books.
Yeah, how do they get away with that, Sean?
How do they get away with that? How do they get away with it?
They get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how many disasters occur under their watch.
Indeed. And here they are again, signing off Carillion with a massive black hole. The truth is they make way more money from mergers and acquisitions by approving firms to buy firms, saying they're in a good state of health to buy firms, and approving those firms to be bought. That's the way many of these large companies have kept on growing. They've had no organic growth. We have a zombie economy, which is surviving on printed money and bond and gilt asset purchase facilities, which the Bank of England does. Fast forward to now, we've got this so-called COVID crisis. It's not because of COVID. The economy was collapsing before COVID hit. If you like, the engine was stuttering, the big ends were failing, we had an oil leak, and then the cooling system sprung a hose. That's the COVID piece coming in. It's just accelerated it and exacerbated it. When this COVID thing gets over and the furlough scheme ends and we finally come out of some of this, there's going to be the mother of all depressions. I'm sure of it. Because many of these zombie firms have been bailed out, but they're still not going to be in a good state of health. Sunak announced 350 billion quid, 30 or 40 billion of that, to subsidise firms to pay people's wages. Where's the other 310 billion gone? If you go on the Bank of England website, you'll see they've spent, I looked about 4 or 6 weeks ago now, up to 600 billion already on asset purchase. This is gilts and bonds being issued to big firms to prop up their share price and to give them liquidity. This is, so we're heading for another £1 trillion already before all the furlough scheme ends, all the small businesses collapse, people go back to jobs that already firms have got plans for shifting stuff offshore again, which they always have. This will accelerate it. There's going to be mass job losses and layoffs because, and particularly because small businesses have received virtually no help.
No, that's right. And on both sides of the border, Sean, that is one heck of a call. Thank you very much for making it. Sarkar is in Glasgow on a very interesting story that is developing in Scotland. Go ahead, Sarkar.
George, fantastic show, and thanks so much for having me on
Thank
the show.
You.
George, first of all, I don't know what to say. You know the hate crime bill, which has been proposed by Hamza Yousaf, the man in SNP. It has been opposed by his own parties, the police, the lawmakers, everyone. This man and SNP and Nicola Sturgeon, because they just don't seem to get. This is a recipe for disaster. I don't know what is going wrong with them and what is the problem when they know there's such a friction in this bill amongst all the communities. Why are they not, you know,
it's the most friendless bill in the whole history of the Scottish Parliament.
Oh, honestly,
it has no friends. The judges, the police, the journalists, the churches, everybody's against it, but they're pressing on regardless.
Honestly, George, and you know something, you know, as much as I'm, you know, despise everything what the SNP does, because I remember once I spoke to you a few weeks ago, you called them Blairites with the kilt on. That was the perfect description, George. Mm. And George, one more thing I'd like to let you know, I'm happy seeing them getting a taste of their own medicine. They love separatism, don't they? Guess what? Shetlands now wants to be separate from Scotland.
And Orkney. And Orkney.
Thank you, George. There you go. So now Nicola Sturgeon will know how it feels to face her own music.
Now there's no oil. It's Scotland's oil becomes Shetland's oil.
Shetland's oil. And that was the whole premise of their independence from when it was in 2014, that the entire oil would be ours. Now, on one hand, Scotland says we're going to go to green energy. And on the other hand, they sell these foolish people. Oil is ours. We can rule the world with that. Come on, you cannot balance that. You cannot.
That's brilliant. A brilliant call, Sarkar. I'd keep it going, but for the hour. But I'll add only this. The only way to keep Scotland united is to keep Scotland in the United Kingdom. That is actually the only way. Scotland spent centuries as warring principalities, and they will all reemerge. The Scotland has been one single country longer in Britain than it ever was in history before the Act of Union, certainly before the Union of the Crowns in the very early 17th century. So the longest period of Scottish unity has been inside the British state. But if there's to be separatism, then all kinds of people will demand that they want to separate from this separatist Scotland. Shetland, which has the oil, Orkney, which has some of the oil. These are places that look north. They are Nordic people. They were actually given to the British Crown as a wedding present. They belong to the Crown, not to the SNP. And they will never agree to leave Britain for a separatist Scotland in Edinburgh, which might as well be in Timbuktu for them. Edinburgh is no nearer to them than London is, politically speaking. But it won't just be that. Dumfries and Galloway will never agree to be torn out of Britain against their will. They'll have to redraw the border. You see my point? You begin the Ulsterisation of Scottish politics is something I'm going to address tomorrow night at 8 o'clock online on my Facebook, Twitter, etc. Because I'm very concerned, as I think you already know, about the possibility of the breakup of this country after more than 300 years. Last call is from Australia. It's Bruce on Japan and World War II. Last week's topic, Bruce wants to weigh in. Let's hear him. Go ahead.
Yes, g'day, George. At the end of the war and about Japan still being, well, in relation to their atrocities, etc., which also applies to Germany and other countries that have happened since, but you really have to, when the war actually comes to an end, those countries are absolutely obliterated. There's a change in government and everything else, and basically you actually have to forgive and pass on. Otherwise, if you don't forgive...
What about compensation when they become rich, Bruce? Germany has paid out a lot of compensation. Japan's paid out none.
I don't believe in that, actually, but I do believe in the victims that are involved with that have a right to make claim, legal or otherwise.
But my point, Bruce, is that Germany has atoned for its crimes. It has apologised endlessly for them. It never lets an occasion go by, an anniversary go by, without again atoning for and sincerely apologising for the crimes that were committed by a previous state. But Japan hasn't done any of that, none of that at all. Instead, Japan has been endlessly rewarded for the acting as a dagger, a potential dagger, at the heart of America's enemies in Asia. And that's what I cannot allow to go undenounced, because there are many people still alive, fewer obviously all the time, that suffered at the hands of the rampaging Japanese fascist empire, which killed millions, tens, scores of millions of people and made slaves of substantial numbers of people. And they haven't even apologized, never mind giving them a little bit of compensation. That's why I can't accept it. It's been marvelous for me. I hope it was for you. See you next week.